morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah. Mark Maron's not here. I'm Mark Riley, I think. This is Morning Sedition. I know. And we've got a very special guest co-host with us in studio. He is... Reverend Al Sharpton.
I think.
Oh, okay. How you doing, Rev?
I'm great. How you doing, Mark?
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
The inimitable Wayne Gilman, the facilitator, the enabler, the man who got the Reverend Al Sharpton in here at the break of dawn, is also here with us in studio.
Why, good morning, gentlemen. I mean, I tell you, it's quite a surprise to see the Reverend at this hour. You know, I know ordinarily he'd be probably in Washington, D.C., you know, engaging in politics somewhere. Actually, I thought
he was literally sleepily talking to you and my cell phone.
That's true, too. Yeah, that's true,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, well, you know, we're going to talk a little politics in here today because there's so much stuff going on. A
lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But let's start from the top, all right? A guy we all know is going to be the new Homeland Security boss, replacing Clutch Cargo, a.k.a. Tom Ridge. We're talking about Bernie Kerik. Chauffeur, bodyguard.
That's what he was.
Cabinet member.
People around the country need to know Bernie Kerik was the chauffeur, bodyguard, a.k.a. police commissioner under Rudy Giuliani during some of the most turbulent times of police misconduct in the history of the city of New York, who really walked in lockstep with Giuliani, whose immediate reaction to any police incident is the police are right.
Yeah.
And I do not think Kerik is one that demonstrated any independent thought at all in public when he was his commissioner and did not seem to have a lot of regard for the civil liberties of the citizens of the city of New York and their even right to question police misconduct, less known to try to deal with any kind of police reform. So in the tradition of the Bush administration thus far, Bernie Kerik is right in line with those that do not see civil liberties as an American right in terms of its citizens.
I just want to say, I think Bush is now setting the stage now that you're no longer under consideration to be Homeland Security Chief, Reverend Sharpton. I think basically what Bush's next move may be that he's going to appoint Rudolph Giuliani as U.S. Attorney General, and both Giuliani and Kerik will work in tandem with each other.
Well, I think, you know, Bush has already made his first appointment there. He, in terms of the Attorney General.
Yeah, Alberto Gonzalez.
Right. But I think that what he is setting a stage for is Giuliani to play on the national stage. And the question is, as one who's just finished a presidential campaign in the Democratic Party, is whether Rudy Giuliani can be sold to the Southern Republicans when he is a pro-choice, pro-gay rights, at least publicly. I don't know that he will ever be the viable candidate nationally that he and his ego thinks he will be.
Remember, he had several openly gay people in his administration,
correct,
in both of his administrations here in New York. But I found it interesting that yesterday, Rudy Giuliani announced he was starting some new investment banking firm.
Right.
And when I heard about Bernie Kerik, the first thing I'm thinking is, gee, you know, Rudy, you remember what happened with Bill Bratton, when Bill Bratton got too big for his britches. So now here comes Rudy announcing on the same day that Kerik has announced that he's starting a new investment bank. Coincidence? I think not.
No, Rudy has never had the capacity to support others, even his own protege, so to speak. His ego is that insecure or monumental or both. And I think that you're right. The coincidence of that announcement to me is something that is clear, you know, leaning back toward this is Rudy being Rudy.
But see, now there is another side to Bernie Kerik. And it was something that I couldn't understand during the time when he was corrections commissioner here in New York, because he was corrections commissioner between the bodyguarding job and the police commissioner's job.
Right.
And black correction officers swore by this guy.
No, they liked him.
They loved him.
He, if you meet him, and I have, in a non-confrontational situation, he's a genuinely decent guy.
In other words, not after a cop has shot some unarmed black kid.
And that Rudy's told him, don't talk to you. You got to remember, a lot of what I've assessed Kerik is, Kerik worked for a guy who just outright demanded, including when Bratton was there.
Yeah.
You do what I say only. You talk to what I say only. But if you met Kerik outside of that, he seemed to be a decent guy. Decency, however, doesn't lead to policy. My problem with Kerik as commissioner was he was implementing, whether he believed it or not, who knows, but he was implementing a policy that was bad. But I could see why a lot of black correction officers in New York liked him when he was commissioner. He was a decent guy. He was a cordial guy. He was an open guy. But when he went to work for Rudy Giuliani, he did not demonstrate the capacity to stand up to his boss. Now, some people think that just makes good career sense, but I think that it follows you the rest of your career.
Well, hey, you make the money when you don't question your boss. But now, after being police commissioner, he was sent over to start training troops in Iraq.
Right.
This is the Iraqi, not troops, the police force
in Iraq. Right.
That police force hasn't really been doing that well. I just read a report this morning about some attack on a police station outside of Baghdad that killed a whole bunch of people. Now, you can't put that on Bernie Kerik necessarily, but how do you assess the job he did in training the Iraqi cops?
Well, clearly George Bush assesses it as being stellar, yes, because he gives him this appointment. I don't know that we have enough information to criticize it, but clearly we can say it doesn't seem to have been so sterling that it received international respect and recognition, as well as I think Kerik was involved in some venture with Rudy Giuliani in Mexico around security. I have not seen an assessment of that. So I think it's going to be very interesting what we see here. But Bush has made the appointment, and what Kerik will do with it, again, I do not think he will ruffle any feathers. He will do what George Bush and them want him to do.
Will he preside over the privatization, the further privatization of agencies under his control? Remember, he now controls 22 different agencies of government. Some of those, including Transportation Security Agency, TSA, they've been talking about privatizing, and they have actually been defunding.
I think
Does that continue?
I think so. I think that is the trend the Bush administration is headed in. I think, again, he will not swim against the tide. There's nothing in his background that gives me any feeling that he would swim against the tide. And I think that this is one of the legacies that the Bush administration wants to leave, and that is privatization of as many government agencies and government functions as they can. I always say this administration believes in privatizing public affairs and making public private decisions. I mean, they want to privatize everything but citizens' private lives.
Now, you speaking of going against the grain, you're going against the grain a little bit, and later this morning we're going to be talking about some of that, because you want to shake up the Democratic National Committee, and you've got a plan to do so, and we're going to have a very special guest joining us in studio, Marjorie Harris, who's executive director of the National Action Network. She's a candidate for vice chair in the DNC. So you're looking to shake that up a little bit. Later this morning as well, we'll be talking with Michael Tomasky, executive editor of the American Prospect, and Bill Roden, New York Times sports columnist, will be here to talk about steroids, Ty Willingham, and a whole bunch of stuff that's going on in the world of sports. But before I go any further, I want to give a shout-out, just in case he's up, which he probably isn't, to my main man, Mark Maron, who is out in Seattle. He is doing Giggles tonight and tomorrow night. Both nights will be recorded for Mark's next CD. All you have to do is go to www.giggleskomedyclub.com for information and tickets. Wayne, are you flying out?
I think I will, the very next
You need a giggle.
Now, we also want to let you know there is a Fight for Democracy rally tomorrow, Saturday, December 4th, at 1 o'clock at the State House in Columbus, Ohio. We got an affiliate out there, so we're being heard in Columbus, Ohio. This is to ensure that every vote in the Ohio election is counted.
That's important.
Go to the links on our links on morningsedition.com for further details on that. And, of course, we will be, not Wayne, though. Wayne ain't going, and I know, Rev, you've got other things to do, but we will be in Boston next Friday, December 10th, for a live broadcast from the Someday Cafe in Davis Square, Somerville. Our guests will include comedian Jimmy Tingle. What a last name. Musician Ted Leo and writer Barry Crimmins. No tickets are necessary. Just come on by, have a cup of Joe, and hang out with the Morning Sedition crew.
I'll come out and get a cup of Joe this morning when I got here.
Well, it's early.
Oh.
Yeah.
So I get a little cup of Joe.
Stay here and you might. we're going to be back.
Be glad you got water.
Hey, wait a minute now. We got a bunch
they
of stuff.
They told me that when I did jail time for VA. You glad you got water.
We're going to take a break. We're going to be back. We got the presidential prom pilot. We're going to talk. I got the dog of the week. You haven't heard about my dogs of the week. And we've also got the liberal agenda coming up, all for you here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. It's more than just a commute companion. Listen online at morningsedition.com when you get to work, courtesy of Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour, and this is BET. No, this is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley with our special guest co-host, the Reverend Al Sharpton, who's knee-deep in the computer, man. I don't know what you're doing over there.
I'm searching. I'm searching. Looking up certain things so I can sound intelligent on your show this morning.
Okay. Now, I want the audience to know this is not the first time the Reverend and I have worked together. 10 years ago, November, what was that, the first Tuesday in November 10 years ago, we were out on a street in Brooklyn, New York, because our telephone lines somehow shorted out on us, and we did an entire broadcast from the streets of Brooklyn on Election Day 1994. Obviously, it didn't work. The Republicans took over Congress that year.
But we were out in the street that day of the Gingrich Revolution.
The Gingrich Revolution.
And by the time we got out of the street, we were out of Congress.
That's right. But you know what? Kwai Sanfumi this week decided to step down as president and CEO of the NAACP, the nation's largest and most venerable civil rights organization. He is given a lot of credit for getting them out of what was some pretty deep debt, I think $3.5 million, something on that, along those lines. Didn't grow the membership, perhaps, at the level that people wanted to see, but it brings up the question, Reverend, and I know you've talked about this on many occasions in the past, the whole question of, A, the quality of leadership that comes out of the NAA, because particularly here, I think, in the New York area and maybe in other major cities, people tend to look at it as an organization that's kind of, some people say, outlived its usefulness.
Well, I don't think it has at all. I think that when you look at the fact that we are facing probably more legal hurdles in civil rights, from affirmative action to corporate discrimination to some very serious questions of civil liberties, the NAACP basically has been the arm of the civil rights movement that deals in the courts. We've got to always remember there are different streams and different traditions in the civil rights movement. The NAACP was always on the legal forefront and the advocacy forefront in terms of constitutional fights and all the way down into their local branches, making sure that people could litigate and protect their rights. So I don't think that there is any void at all in terms of the need for that, given the challenges of the day. I think sometimes a lot of outside the civil rights community observers don't understand the difference in roles. Martin Luther King's tradition, stream, whatever you want to call it, was more activist, proactive, nonviolent confrontation oriented, which complemented Roy Wilkins in that time, which complemented the corporate work of a Whitney Young in that time. So when I hear people talk about the NAACP today, we need people or someone at the NAACP helm that is more like I was reading, I think it was Professor Walter say we need people like
Ron Walter
say like a Jackson or a Sharpton there. What we do is more in a king tradition. Wilkins was not king.
Yeah.
And therefore Mfume should not be expected to be us, or whoever replaces him would not necessarily be that, because that is not the necessarily the tradition of the NAACP.
Who would you want to see replace Kwai Sanfumi?
I mean, I don't have a candidate right now. I think that it has to
but
be.
But you talk to people.
I talk to people all the time, but I still don't have a candidate. I think it has to be someone that could probably bring the organization into a real cutting-edge position, given the challenges that I think we will see go in front of the Supreme Court with a new reconfiguration of that court likely to happen under George Bush. I think that we're going to see an affirmative action case go back up. And we barely got by the last one with a 5-4 vote. If Bush chooses 2-3 Supreme Court justices, that's in real jeopardy. I think we're going to need someone there that can continue to raise money to keep the organization solvent. All civil rights organizations, ours, National Action Network, all civil rights organizations are in some kind of debt, large or small.
Well, see, now you're bringing up something that is troubling to a lot of people. To what extent do you think the black community and the larger civil rights community, which is not all black, is prepared to back the NAACP against this apparent assault by the IRS?
That is going to be my third point, which may have should have been my first, because they're going to come under serious challenge with this IRS investigation, because I do not think it has anything to do with the NAACP. I think it has a lot more to do with this administration trying to politically punish those that would question them. Not even from a standpoint of supporting the opposition, but how dare you question us? And if they can use the NAACP losing its IRS tax exempt status as a signal, as a warning shot, as something to paralyze other groups, they will be able to in many ways silence those that would dare question their policies. And I think that that is why this NAACP investigation becomes very, very critical and very important.
You think that the new president is going to have to fend this off, and he's going to have to lead the NAACP's conduct through this investigation?
Absolutely. And I think he's going to have to expose to the American public what it is, and that is political punishment. It is absolutely absurd to say that the chairman of the NAACP at their national convention cannot question the policies of an incumbent president without being accused of engaging in partisan politics. Let's remember, Mark, George Bush himself went to the National Urban League Convention.
Yes, he did.
And asked for votes. So why isn't anyone questioning the IRS status of the Urban League? Nor should they, because I think the Urban League had John Kerry there and Bush. And I'm certainly not advocating.
And the NAACP invited Bush. He just said he had a schedule.
So then what is the difference? Yeah. I mean, if you're invited to a conference, you don't attend, you're criticized policy-wise by the chairman who didn't endorse your opponent, didn't criticize you based on your opponent, but made his own assessment, but you could have come, laid out your case as Kerry came and laid out his. You go to another national civil rights organization and not only lay out your case but ask for votes. Is that of IRS violation? He actually politically campaigned at the other convention. They need a president that can lay that out to America and say, wait a minute, this is ridiculous.
Now, I know we have some listeners saying, well, when are they going to talk about something white? But I
thought we were.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I know.
I'm just being facetious. I can't do the rim shot anymore. You know, we don't want to overuse our little board over here. But, I mean, look, we're going to continue this conversation because I think it's important, an important one to have, because some of the people on the right that do the same things that they're accusing the NAACP of doing are not being investigated by anybody.
So stay tuned. I'm
going
to bring Mark mainstream when we come back. I'm trying to cross you over, Mark.
Thank you very much. The Reverend Al Sharpton is our special guest co-host. We've got the presidential palm pilot coming up, the dog of the week, and the liberal agenda here on Air America Radio. It's 34 past the hour, Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Riley with my special guest co-host for today, the Reverend Al Sharpton, filling in for my main man, Mark Maron. Before we continue our conversation, though, this is the time of the morning when Ramon usually stops by with the information downloaded from the Palm Pilot of someone in the administration. We haven't seen Ramon so far this morning, but Mark Maron is out in Seattle where he's performing tonight at Giggles, and he called in with this message for us.
So I just wanted to let you know, Riley, that Ramon is traveling with me. He's roading for me. And, dude, this guy can get anything, anywhere. And he got me the Carlos Gutierrez Palm Pilot for today. If you don't know, I know you do, Riley, but he's Bush's Commerce Secretary. He's the nominee, and he was the CEO of Kellogg's. Here's his schedule. 8 a.m., wake up, shut off Tony the Tiger alarm clock. It's 8. 9 a.m., have a big breakfast of pancakes. Don't have to pretend I like cereal anymore. 10 a.m., overhaul manufacturing sector of economy. But first, more pancakes. Noon, meet with President Bush. Thank him for the big sombrero lamp he gave me for new office. 12:30 p.m., throw out big sombrero lamp. He'll never remember. 2 o'clock p.m., find out who's been sending emails to me as Captain Crunch. 4 o'clock p.m., first big act as Commerce Secretary. Drive Bush twins to new part-time sales job at Lady Foot Locker. I got them for Christmas. 7 o'clock p.m., meeting with Cheney. Tell him, yes, I would like a painting of myself on display in the White House, but not on black velvet. 9 o'clock p.m., check messages. 9 05 p.m., leave to pick up fired Bush twins at mall. They are not going to screw this up for me. I've worked too hard. 11 p.m., lights out. Make mental note. I wonder if I can finally get my face on a Wheaties box now.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Commerce Secretary nominee Carlos Gutierrez's Palm Pilot for today.
Interesting.
Very interesting, isn't it, Rev?
Very.
Now, back to the business at hand. Black leadership, the NAACP, the future of, you know, there are some younger black people who don't really think that we need a civil rights movement anymore. Why are they wrong?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think that it's a lot of misinformation in terms of how we address this. You know, I meet a lot of young people as I travel and speak that say, well, I wasn't here for Selma and Birmingham. I told them I wasn't either. I mean, I was about 8 or 9. I said, but you were here for Abner Louima. You were here for Rodney King. You were here for the affirmative action fight. I think it's a misnomer that young people are not in an era that civil rights is still being fought out. And I think they let people talk about back in the day like there are no problems today. The fact of the matter is, in the height of the 60s, most people were not involved in the civil rights movement. We get this picture today that because a lot happened then, that everybody was involved. The largest march in the history of that whole era was the March on Washington, August 28, 63.
Yes.
And there was only 250,000 people there. In 95, the Million Man March had five times that many people there. So I think that we misinterpret the lack of involvement today like there was maximum involvement in the 60s. There wasn't then. It was always been a committed group who usually influenced the majority, but never was the majority that was active. And I think a lot of young people must admit they're not involved, not because there's no need and not because there are no movements, but because they're just not involved. And some of their parents were not involved either when it was time to be involved.
Well, talk about their mamas like that. Listen, there's a thing that I'm looking at, and bear with me, audience, while I try and connect the dots here, because I've been seeing this ongoing crisis in the Ukraine, where there are thousands of people that have surrounded buildings, that have protested, that have literally stopped the Ukraine in its tracks,
right,
over who's going to be their next president. And I keep thinking, what would have happened in 2000 if America's reaction had been the same?
Well, I think that we might have had a different result. And some of us have questioned even if the Ohio vote and need for recount today,
yes,
had similar action, whether there would be a difference. One of the things that I'm very upset about, very concerned about, very disturbed about is how passive we took 2000. I went to Florida. National Action Network, the organization I had, filed a lawsuit on behalf of voters down there. We had actual members of our Miami Fort Lauderdale chapter that were the plaintiffs, and we as an organization. And we were asked by the leaders of the Democratic Party nationally at that time to pull out of Florida. And I think it was the lack of reaction that helped to accommodate the selection of George Bush in 2000. And I salute and applaud those in Ohio that, despite the concession of John Kerry nationally, that are still fighting for a recount now. That's why I hope people join them tomorrow in Columbus.
Did he concede too soon? Did he give up Ohio too fast?
Let me put it this way. I was in Boston. I was certainly, I campaigned all over this country for John Kerry, over 80 cities. I nor anyone I know in the high reaches of the campaign were consulted before a concession was made. If I had been asked, I would have said, don't concede, let's fight it out. You must remember, Mark, that at 2 o'clock in the morning, John Edwards came out and said, we will count every vote.
Yeah, I remember.
8 or 9 hours later, John Kerry called and conceded to President Bush. We made the commitment. We will count every vote. That's what John Edwards said at 2 in the morning. I think we should have stayed by that position.
Let's talk presidential let's talk presidential politics for a minute. The election's over, obviously, so that aspect of it's done. But we see George Bush, I think, in the most political sense, rewarding the Latino community for a rather large single-digit increase in the percentage. I think it went from 35 to 42 to 44, depending on who you talk to. We see Carlos Gutierrez. We see Alberto Gonzalez. We see, you know, Condoleezza Rice. Will the Republicans be able to say to communities of color when the second Bush term is done, look, we've been the most inclusive administration in history?
Well, I think that that is probably what he is attempting to do. But I think that he tried that in this time. He tried to say to the African-American community, I gave you Colin Powell, the first black Secretary of State. I gave you Condoleezza Rice, first black National Securities Advisor. It didn't work. He did not increase at all or any substantial increase in African-American community because the policies they represented were against the interests of African-Americans. And I think that is the same argument we will be able to raise in the Latino community. I think he's not necessarily rewarding them as much as he's trying to continue a growth there by saying to them, I'll give you more to get more. And I think what they've got to look at is not the nationality or the race of his appointees, but the policies. If you have a Latino attorney general, but they don't protect you in terms of immigration rights, they don't protect you in terms of those that are going with these English-only right-wing educational policies, they don't protect your civil rights and civil liberties, does it matter to you that it's somebody of your race? Clarence Thomas is of my race. I think he's one of the worst selections to the Supreme Court in American history. So I think that we've got to argue to people that everybody that's your color is not your kind. All your skin folk ain't your kin folk.
Now, George W. Bush is not vocally behind this yet, but we've seen now an assault on U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan that is ongoing. Yes. Coleman from Minnesota, I believe, was the first one to fire the shot across the bow, saying that the scandal in the Iraq oil food program should cost Kofi Annan his job as Secretary General. A, will Bush get behind this? And B, what do you think people who don't agree with him ought to do about it?
Well, I think that Bush is probably already tacitly behind it. And I think that clearly this is a shot that the Bush administration is certainly not going to stop. At some point may even get behind and push. But I don't think that Kofi Annan is the target. I think the UN is the target. I think that there is clearly been the posture of this administration from its unilateral international involvement, a spirit of we don't need a collective world body about anything. We are the superpower and we will make the decision. And I think that they will try to hang Kofi Annan as a prelude to try and really bring the UN into a position where it becomes almost irrelevant. I don't think we should allow that to happen. I don't think Kofi Annan has demonstrated anything but stellar leadership. This involvement of his son needs to be handled in the proper way. But so far, that's all we know it to be is his son. And there is
and apparently he didn't tell his daddy everything.
Absolutely. So and clearly there is no evidence at all that would lead anyone to feel that Kofi Annan has done anything improper here.
Mm-hmm. We are going to take a quick break.
I mean, Bush knows about kids. I mean, if we want to really go there now.
See, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I've got the dog of the week. And we got the liberal agenda later on this morning. Marjorie Harris, executive director of the National Action Network. Michael Tomasky, executive editor of the American Prospect. And New York Times columnist Bill Roden, all here on Air America Radio.
Morning Edition on Air America Radio.
Rev and I have this in common, by the way. It's 49 minutes past the hour, 11 minutes to the hour. I'm Mark Riley. This is Morning's Edition. Mark Maron is out in Seattle. He's doing giggles tonight in Seattle, tonight and tomorrow. The Reverend Al Sharpton is sitting in as my very special guest co-host. Good morning again, Reverend.
Good morning again, Mark.
But, you know, James, I used to idolize James Brown as a kid.
We used to.
We'll get into that. But first, it's time for my very own dog of the week. This week, we go back to the world of sports for our dog of the week, or should I say dogs. Steroid use in baseball has been hinted at for a long time. Yet with a couple of exceptions, rumors were all that anyone had to go on until this week. Now, two of the game's superstars have admitted taking performance-enhancing steroids before a grand jury. The San Francisco Chronicle reports Barry Bonds and Jason Giambi have fessed up. Bonds says he has no clue the cream his personal trainer Greg Anderson was giving him was anything but flaxseed oil. Yeah, right. Giambi was more forthcoming, saying he knowingly used roids going back to his days with the Oakland A's. In fact, Morning Sedition got this exclusive statement from Giambi.
Licka, licka, hi, licka, honey, ho. Licka, licka, hi, licka, honey, ho. Licka, licka, hi, licka, chunny, ho. Licka, licka, hi, licka, chunny, ho. Mola, licka, mala, licka, chala, mola.
Whoa! The wish is granted. Long live Giambi.
Yeah, right. Whatever. Public opinion polls say most baseball fans don't care as much about steroid use as they do about gambling. Yet Major League Baseball is faced with a vexing problem. Bonds and Giambi are major stars. Bonds will likely break Henry Aaron's home run record sometime in 06. Both should have known better than to take any substance without knowing exactly what it was. Since the substances they took were designed not to show up on tests, it makes them look all the more guilty. It also makes Barry Bonds and Jason Giambi our Morning Sedition Dogs of the Week.
Ooh.
Can you put an asterisk next to those records? Dan Pashman, our esteemed editorial producer,
yes, sir,
has joined us, and sports maven has joined us in studio, since Mike and the Mad Dog are otherwise engaged. And, Pashman, what do you think of this now? Barry Bonds.
I know. I'm glad it's finally coming out. I'm glad the truth's coming out. And I'd be happy to see both of these guys go down along with the rest of them who've been taking steroids. I especially have it in for Bonds just because of the records that he's setting as a huge baseball fan. Numbers are important to a big baseball fan. Great records. And I want Hank Aaron to keep the home run record. He is the home run king. He earned that record. And I don't want Bonds to get it.
You're scaring me, man. I thought you didn't want Bonds to get it because he's black.
No.
You sure?
Hank Aaron is black, too, by the way.
I know.
But, I mean, wouldn't just a simple...
I was wrong.
Wouldn't that have sufficed?
Absolutely.
How about that? If they had both said...
I was wrong.
What?
Absolutely not. I mean, these guys... You gotta think, guys, I grew up with a placemat that had all the baseball records on it, all right? Listed all the home run kings, and it said Henry Aaron, 755. All my growing up years, eating my cereals, Henry Aaron, 755. Now, I don't want my kid to have a placemat that says Barry Bonds at the top of that list when the guy was taking drugs.
Did you ever get over this placemat?
Yeah, right.
You still
have it?
Actually, I do. It's in Brooklyn in my apartment.
Oh, wow.
That's a great placemat.
What position he is.
Yeah. Editorial position. When we were young, we didn't have, Henry Aaron wasn't until 74. I was a grown man by then. We had
a very grown
fat
man.
Guy. Yeah, thank you very much. We had to deal with the fat guy from Baltimore for all the years I was grown up. He was the icon. He was, now he was also an alcoholic, apparently, but I know.
What fat man from Baltimore?
Yeah, who are you talking about?
Babe Ruth, man!
That was actually the 20th century?
I don't know, was it?
Well,
yeah.
You were growing up.
Wait a minute now. Wait. You're not that much younger than me, Red. We don't want to go where your birthday party was.
When I was growing up, the only babe I knew was Hello Dolly on Broadway.
Oh, no, wait a minute now. I know that you... try to tell people. But, you still got those hairs, man. The hairs are getting a little gray.
That's from the struggle. That's not because of your age.
Is that from doing the time in Vieques?
I got a few there, yeah.
I can imagine.
I got a question for you guys. I'm curious, how do you think, if at all, that Bonds and Giambi may be treated differently in the press with the scandal coming out with both of them at the same time?
I think it's going to feed a fire. I think you're going to see a lot of headlines. This won't be a one-day story. And I think given their celebrity, it will probably ignite a fundamental shift in this whole policy in baseball. I think you're right. Because of who they are, it won't, go away as quickly.
Right. Wait a minute. Now, do you think...
Especially Bonds.
Do you buy the idea, A, that Bonds didn't know what he was taking?
No, not for a second.
You don't buy that?
No.
Rev?
I don't know enough about it. I don't have a placemat with all the baseball teams. My sport is boxing, things like that. I do like baseball. I go occasionally to Yankee games. But even I was shocked when I heard Barry Bonds, because everybody, whether you're an avid baseball fan or not, know who Barry Bonds is and what he stands to be historically in terms of baseball.
Right. Now, neither Bonds nor Giambi have denied what the San Francisco Chronicle has said. Their lawyers have been upset about the fact that they think the government leaked the grand jury testimony, but they have not denied that what either one of them said was true. If it turns out to be true and accurate that both Bonds and Giambi used steroids, Giambi knowingly, Bonds unknowingly, what would be your sanction if you were Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig?
I think you'd have to move to suspend them. I think that you, if it is in fact true, and we again don't know, and it is very noteworthy that grand jury proceedings are secret, and all of a sudden the San Francisco Chronicle will have the testimony.
Angling for their Pulitzer.
Well, that, you know, a lot of times people write things that are untrue, angling for Pulitzer. There's been a few Pulitzer winners that were suspended. So everything that, as you know, written doesn't make it true.
This is true.
And so let's not jump to conclude that because it was written it is true. I've had more things written about me false than true. But if it was true.
You just had a lot of things written about you.
Absolutely. But if it is true and they admit it, then I think that that is grounds for suspension.
Yeah, I agree with the Reverend 100%. I would even go a step further and say that I think that every statistic that Bonds and Giambi and anyone else they get accrued in the time that they were found to have been taking steroids should be erased from the books.
But you know what? They won't have been found. Remember that the steroids involved here were made and designed not to show up on tests. So they're not going to get, I mean, this is as big, as close to the smoking gun as they're actually going to get.
Right. And that's one of the things that's frustrating, but hopefully at least the court of public opinion will find them guilty enough that they'll face a price there.
But does the public really care? Yes or no?
Yes.
I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll discuss that a little bit later on this morning when Bill Roden comes in. Mark Maron is traveling in Seattle today. But this time every morning, he reads us the day's marching orders from the Streisand compound for all you good liberals out there. And even though he's out of town, nothing can stop him from delivering today's liberal agenda.
Thanks, Riley. I had Streisand actually fax it to me here at the hotel in Seattle. By the way, I'm in Seattle tonight and tomorrow night. How would that be if you come down? GigglesComedyClub.com. Check it out. Anyways, here's the liberal agenda. Write these down. One, refer to all of Bush's new cabinet appointees as temps. Two, call Tom Brokaw. Now that he's retired, offer him a job on Morning Sedition reading today's liberal agenda. Huh? Three, add a new subject to public school curriculum, conflict resolution between arrogant millionaire athletes and irresponsible drunken fans. Four, deface Lemony Snicket movie posters to read George W. Bush's A Series of Unfortunate Events. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. There are only 22 days until Christmas, but how many days until the end of the war in Iraq? Now that would be a present, man. Wake up, people.
Right. That's our liberal agenda, direct from the Streisand compound. So that wasn't as painful as a root canal, right, Rev?
Absolutely.
We've gone through an hour already.
That's right.
And coming up in the next hour, Marjorie Harris, candidate for the vice chairpersonship of the Democratic National Committee and executive director of the National Action Network joins us. And we've also got Rapture Watch from Cardinal Milpington when we come back here on Air America Radio. Good morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. I only did that because Maron does it every morning. Mark Maron's not here. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is in Seattle. He is performing tonight and tomorrow night at Giggles Comedy Club. Both nights will be recorded for Mark's next CD. Go to www.giggleskomedyclub.com for information and tickets. If you're just waking up, then you don't know who my special guest co-host is. He is presidential candidate, former head of the National Action Network, and all-around activist and nice guy, the Reverend Al Sharpton. Good morning, Rev.
They fired me from National Action Network?
I don't know.
I thought I was still there.
I thought our guest was the executive director.
Yeah,
NASA,
but I'm still, I think they still let me come to the office, but I'm here. I'm Al Sharpton.
You are Al Sharpton.
I am certain.
He's I'm here, in the flesh.
I'm not the former Al Sharpton.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And this is not the former Air America.
And you're not the former Mark Rapp.
That's right. But we got a very
special... No, we're not sure.
No, thank loads. We got a very special guest who's joining us in studio this morning. She is the executive director of the National Action Network. Let us say good morning to Marjorie Harris. Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. How
good
are you?
Good to see you again. How
nice
you
to see you. I'm doing great.
Excellent.
Doing well.
So you're stepping out here. You're going to run for the vice chairmanship of the Democratic National Committee.
That I am.
You got guts. Why are you running?
I told her the sharks will be coming.
Yeah, they will, but that's okay. Why are you running?
I am running because I was out on the campaign trail, of course, as senior advisor to Reverend Sharpton. And prior to that, I had consistent with that, I also had a voter registration drive going on for about 2 years. And I saw that there were so many people out there that were still being overlooked in the process, that were not being represented, their concerns, their issues. A lot of the people that we serve, you know, through the National Action Network, and a lot of the people that we registered through the Truth Hamer Initiative, there's a lot of people out there whose concerns, you know, their platform is not being heard, and I think that we need some new energy in the party. I think we need some people with new ideas who've been out there on the ground recently. And know what, you know, the party needs. They need an infusion of new ideas and energy.
Now, what issues are not being properly addressed by the party? What wasn't properly addressed during the campaign?
The basic issues, education, you know, public education is a major concern, health care.
But Kerry said he had a plan to cut the number of people uninsured down to, 20 million or something?
Yeah, but the people that, you know, we represent, the people that I've been working with for the past few years, their voices still weren't heard in the platform and in the process. And the people that they were reaching out to when they would visit the stage, you know, they still weren't hitting the ground. They still weren't hitting the grassroots level. And a lot of these people's concerns just still weren't heard. You know, so the basics, the education, health care, among the hip-hop voters, things like, you know, HIV/AIDS in the black community. I mean, a lot of these issues, you know, Sudan wasn't addressed until the very last minute. Internationally. So there are a lot of issues that our constituency is concerned with that we feel still was not addressed, and I think that the party needs to hear from us.
I think that one of the things, and you and I were talking about this off air, Mark, one of the things that I give Marjorie Harris credit for saying, you really gave him credit for saying, is that the overwhelming majority of people of color do not consider themselves, quote, middle class, even though many of us are. But they consider themselves working class because they had to work to become middle class.
Yes.
And I think that the emphasis of the party on the middle class didn't connect to people that may be very much economically middle class, but see themselves as working class because they have to work, their wives have to work, to struggle to be and maintain a middle class status. Now, that's not semantics, because when people hear middle class, you may be making $100,000 a year. If you don't see yourself as that, you say, they're not talking to me because I'm a working class guy. I've got to get up and go to work every day. I've got to work two jobs. Yeah, I've got a 2-car garage. Yeah, I've got a nice house, but I work. And I think that this lack of identity helped to establish a disconnect. And if the party doesn't remedy that, where we represent the middle class and the working class and actively identify with the issues and concerns and the fears and the insecurities, we will not be able to pull out the vote that is necessary. There is definitely a disconnect. And I don't think John Kerry is not as simplistic as John Kerry's candidacy. I think the structure of the party, the strategy of the party and how it is funneled down through its state parties into its local apparatus is what has failed. The infrastructure is not geared in a way to maximize our vote. And unfortunately, the Republicans have been able to do the reverse on their side of the ideological battle here.
You know, it's interesting because there's an article in one of the papers today. It says that Democratic governors across the country, many of whom were elected in states where John Kerry lost to George W. Bush, are now saying that they need these local issues. But this brings up a larger question. And Marjorie Harris, I want to get your feelings on this. Is there, and we're going to take this past the break and go into the next segment with it, is there a disconnect between the mainstream of the black community within the Democratic Party and the white liberal wing of the Democratic Party?
Absolutely.
There is.
I agree.
How did it happen? How do you deal with it?
Well, I think that again, you know, I believe that there were issues that, you know, within the mainstream black community just were never addressed. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, throughout the campaign, I think that they thought by visiting a couple of churches, they would address the issue.
The Sunday syndrome.
They could go in, you know, and clap with the chorus, you know, with the choir, and that would solve the issue. And they need to understand that there are a lot, the issues are a lot deeper, a lot more pervasive. You know, I just read last week that, black admissions are down in state universities around the country. These are the types of things that they need to address, but they cannot do it if they don't have people who are on the ground and who know what's going on. And, you know, there are some good people in the party. I'm not complaining about them, but I do believe that they need to work with a lot of the younger people. You know, I worked closely, you know, with Russell Simmons and, you know, Puffy when we were registering voters. And, you know, it's one thing to register these young voters, but you have to know what's important to them. And I think that that's where the disconnect begins. You know, it begins with the fact that we have two different constituencies of voters, and you have to know what their issues are.
I think, I want to hit a question right on the head, and that is, I think that we've got to be honest that a lot of the liberals, as we call it, have always resisted independent black leadership that they did not sponsor. If you look at, we talked earlier about the NAACP, if you look at civil rights leadership, part of the problem is unless we were sponsored and anointed by the liberals that saw us more as their property than their partners, we had much more problems out of them than anyone else. The liberal media were the ones.
Wait, you're on the liberal media.
Well,
now,
the liberal media have been the ones that have been the most scathing and unfair with independent black leadership. So when you ask that question, you've got to ask the question, why do we eat our own? Are we really liberal? Or are we saying, you are right as long as you do what I say? And you have a new generation of black leaders that are saying, we're not looking for better slave masters, we're looking for freedom. And the Sunday syndrome doesn't work anymore for one very simple reason. Mark Riley don't go to church on Sunday.
Wait a minute. I'm the usher this coming Sunday in my own home church, pal.
Mark, it starts at 11 o'clock.
Wait, no. I'll be there at 9.
You'll be there at 3. It starts at 11.
We've got to take a break. Marjorie Harris, the executive director of the National Action Network and candidate for vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, is here with us, along with my special guest co-host, the Reverend Al Sharpton. I'm going to talk to you on the telephones at 1-866-303-2270. We want to find out what you think about some of the issues that we're discussing. 1-866-303-2270. When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. We can't do it without you. Call us at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. Right here on Air America Radio.
It's Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. It is 20 minutes past the hour. Mark Maron is in Seattle getting ready for his Giggles Comedy Club gig tonight and tomorrow. And they're recording a CD. You can get there. www.giggleskomedystore.com. Our special guest co-host, the Reverend Al Sharpton. And with us in studio, the executive director of the National Action Network, Ms. Marjorie Harris. She's also a candidate for the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. Now, that vote will take place in February?
In February, the first weekend.
The first weekend. Now, how do you line up votes?
It's a matter of campaigning the 430-something members of the DNC.
How many of you talked to?
I've talked to several. You know, Reverend Sharpton is leading me, as well as Donna Brazile and Alexis Herman. So we've been kind of taking calls, you know, one at a time. Next week I'll be in Washington meeting with some people. So it's a matter of campaigning each of the members individually.
Okay. We're going to go to our telephones at 866-303-2270. Let us go first to Noah, who's calling us from New York on WLIB. Noah, good morning.
Hi, guys. How are you?
All right. How you doing?
Not too bad. I'm the publisher of nationalview.org and the Kerry volunteer site, roadtriptovictory.org.
Ah.
I'm also involved in, deeply involved in Jersey politics. I actually live in Jersey. I'm in New York right now.
Okay.
We were at a meeting sponsored by Women for Kerry about 2.5-3 weeks ago, and when it was my turn to finally speak, I noticed that there wasn't one face in the crowd that was black. 200 people, not one face in the crowd that was black.
That sounds like a Nader meeting more than Kerry.
Yeah. Well, this wasn't the case of us not reaching out to the black community. What it was a case was not including them, and I, there's a difference in the two. We don't need to tell them what's important to them from our perspective. We want them to tell us. We want the leaders of the black community, especially in New Jersey, because that's where I'm concentrating on, to tell us what's important to them and have them get involved in our process the way, not just go on Sundays to certain black churches in Newark and Camden. We want them to be leaders of our party, to take that step and become involved in what we're all trying to accomplish.
Yeah, become a part of the fabric.
Important.
Yeah, that's
because, well, see, I think that's what we see, and, you know, the Amsterdam News has a front page story this week about Ms. Harris's run and Congressman Meeks. I think that's what we're talking about with the DNC. Blacks voted 90-91% for Kerry. We came out with a larger vote than we ever did for Kerry.
3 million larger.
Correct. Now, and a lot of that was young voters that were registered for the first time, a lot of it from various drives, including hers. Now, will the party reflect that in its leadership? Are we just going to continue to deliver numbers and the infrastructure never reflect that we are the consistent number deliverers? Or are we going to be part of the structure so that we are included in the process, therefore those numbers increase? I think that Noah's point is the right point.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there was this sense at a point during this last election cycle where people were saying, some people I talked to were certainly saying, well, you know, Kerry's people get into that, well, you're part of the base thing.
Right.
Which is intended apparently to be a compliment, but not everybody takes it as such. Have you heard that, Marjorie Harris, at all, where people, black people say, you know, I resent just people assuming I'm part of the base?
Right. Well, you know, as well they should be. You know, particularly in southern states, you know, that was one of our heavy grounds, you know, South Carolina, you know, we went through Georgia, you know, and these were states that were wholeheartedly just written off through the campaign. And, you know, we've said this, and, you know, I know that Reverend Sharpton and Donna Brazil have echoed it as well, and that is that we have to be a party of 50 states. And to, you know, overlook your vote in, you know, particularly the black vote in places like Mississippi, in Louisiana, you just can't, you know, write these people off. And so I can understand your point.
All right, let's go next to Xavier, who's listening to us on WXXM in the great city of Madison, Wisconsin. Xavier, good morning.
Good morning, Mark and Reverend Shelton and is it Margaret?
Marjorie.
Sorry. I have to say that I have to agree with what Reverend Al was saying. He, when he pointed out that black leaders that aren't condoned by the liberal media get really attacked. And you know, I saw it when I listened to his campaign during the primaries. A lot of people are saying, hey, he doesn't have a chance because he's black. He doesn't have a chance because he's a reverend. He's going to bring in the religious people and only connect with them. They had people saying that he wasn't going to connect with people because, well, he's focused more on his hair or, you know, all kinds of little off-the-wall comments.
Are you jogging or something over there, Xavier? Sounds like you're out of breath. You okay?
I just ran up 5 flights of stairs. Sorry.
Oh, okay. All right. That's cool.
That's all right. I usually talk to Mark while I'm on the treadmill. Don't worry.
Well, let's let Reverend speak to that. Xavier,
I think he's absolutely right. And it's not just me. If you think of anybody, name me one independent black leader in history that the liberal media didn't attack. Name one. If it was King,
Joe Lewis.
Well, I'm only kidding. If it was King, who they call a philanderer and a plagiarist and a tax cheat. I mean, and now he's a national holiday. I mean, it is an absolute given that that's what they're going to do. And then at the same time, they turn around and say, but are you going to be loyal to us? And unless you're some kind of masochist, at some point you got to say, you know what? I'm not going to engage in this kind of behavior anymore out of you.
Mm-hmm. Folks, before we take another call, who would you like to see as chair, each of you, as chair of the DNC?
Would you like to run?
No.
I mean,
in a word, no.
I'm not being facetious.
I have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to be here. I can't run for
every
DNC.
Day is a new scorecard. People are in or out. I think it's very difficult to say. That's why I think that what Greg Meeks and I and Marjorie Harris and I and Donna Brazil and others have said is that we want to deal with the structure as we move toward whoever may be chairman, because clearly at this point is who's on first, who's on second. There are no clear candidates, and we've not united around one. Wellington Webb is certainly the most interesting of them if he puts a campaign together that I have said. I'm talking personally. Now, I'm not speaking for Marjorie or Donna, any of them.
Now, Wellington Webb is the former mayor of Denver, Colorado. Yeah, who has been touted, but apparently does have one or two problems with unions.
Well, again, I think he's meeting with them to see if that can be resolved. So there's no clear candidate at this point for me.
Does Howard Dean look good to you?
I mean, Howard Dean and I are talking. A lot of people are talking. We are supporting Mr. Congressman Meeks and Ms. Harris officially. The rest we will have to see.
Really? So you're going to talk to all the other contenders?
Yes, as I said, we'll give you an appointment.
Not likely, listen. But I think it's fascinating that this is a relatively open process. Let's see, do we have time for one more real quick one? All right, Kendrick in New Jersey, listening to WLIV. Kendrick, make it real quick.
Yeah, I just want to say I would like to address the issue concerning Mr. Kofi Annan. My name is Kendrick Cloud. I'm originally from Liberia.
Okay.
And also to tell.
Okay. Well, tell. Make it real, real quick, because we're almost out of time.
I just want to know why African American leaders don't support Liberian positions, especially.
Okay. Now let me try and answer that. Thank you very much for the call. I have, in my few years here on the radio, gone into the whole Charles Taylor thing in Liberia. We went into at some length. Rev, you were here for a good deal of that.
And I went to Ghana last year. All of us are part of a delegation to deal with that issue. And as I said this morning about Kofi Annan, I do not think that we can hold him any more responsible for his child than we hold Bush for his, unless there is evidence to directly show he had knowledge and participation.
All right. We're going to be right back with Rapture Watch and so much more here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Dan Air Guitar Passman is back in the studio. This is Morning Sedition. Mark Maron is in Seattle getting ready to do Giggles Comedy Club. And the Reverend Al Sharpton is here with us, along with Marjorie Harris, who's Executive Director of the National Action Network. Marjorie, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. And we're going to be following your progress as you head toward that vice chairmanship, or chairpersonship, I guess I should say. That's the right way you tell me.
Get it right.
Chairperson.
Chairpersonship.
Yeah.
Get it right.
The Democratic.
We've always tried to raise you.
Yeah, I know. You've been trying to raise me right all of these years.
From the streets to the suites, and you still don't know.
You're better than I do now.
LIV to Air America, and you still make politically incorrect statements.
I know.
What am I going to do with you? Your brother Clayton must be hanging his head.
The Bible's book of Revelation, now everybody's going to really hang their heads. The Bible's book of Revelation portends the end of days and the second coming of the Christian Messiah, one of our president's favorite stories. Though no one knows when the end times will come, there are signs that will appear to men. Here on Morning Sedition, we won't let you get caught off guard by the end of the world. That's why we present this week's Rapture Watch with MILF Cardinal Milfington of the recently disgraced Diocese of Corpus Christi, Texas. Your grace?
Listen closely, ye nattering nabobs of Satan. Heed my exhortations, thou boggle-mystic Apollonians. Take some notes, for Christ's sake, ye Albigensian schismatistical Hebleophorites. For the end times are things I gotta do today. Buy clothespins, get extra large cat box liners, and call the doctor about that thing on my neck. Okay, guys, that's the second time somebody put their refrigerator notes in with my script. I don't care who did it. I just want it to stop, all right? Anywho, last hip domino, I told you about something important, but it slipped my mind. The week before that, I'm pretty sure I discussed something just as important that I can't recall either. And the week before that, I'm almost certain I told you that huffing airplane glue in your mid to late 40s is probably bad for your short-term memory. What's that? I didn't break it, Daddy. It was like that when I came home. And long-term memory. But now it's time to pack up your non-Christian crap and hop the last train to the ninth level of Hellville, you Masonic perverts, because you're about to spend an eternity stuck in Lodi again. For according to my paper of choice, the New York Post, swarms of locusts, not seen since the days of Von Meter, are now devouring Israel, Egypt, and Palestine. And even worse, the invasion is causing these countries to unite against insects instead of concentrating on what they should be doing, killing each other. For it was prophesied in Revelation 25:25, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, whoa, whoa, whoa. Quote, and the three horns which thou sawest are three kings, which receive power as kings with the beast. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast as a trilateral coalition against damage to gardens and hotel property. End quote. Man, that's good glue. End quote. Man, that's good glue. Did I just say that? Could it be any clearer, you satanic knights of Mithridates? Even the countries we depend on to hate each other are now joining together. But in the mark of the beast. It won't be long before all warring nations in the Mideast join together in peace. And that's God's here to come kill us all. And that's a good thing, I think. I mean, wait, let me refresh my memory. Yeah, good glue. So watch out, Hedonites. Soon the locusts will be upon you. And then they'll want all your glue supplies. In the meantime, keep on fornicating, fornicators. And we'll keep the light on for you. In hell.
Milf, Cardinal Milfington. Didn't I hear you preach a sermon that was kind of similar to that, Reverend?
Yeah. Right.
Well,
I think the Cardinal's in a class by himself.
Yeah, a class room by himself, apparently. Right now, joining us on our telephone line is a distinguished executive editor of the American Prospect, Mr. Michael Tomasky. Michael, how you doing?
I'm good. My material is not quite that sharp this morning, gentlemen. I hope you'll bear with me.
That's all right. Say good morning to Reverend Sharpton.
Hi, Al.
Good morning, Mr. Tomasky.
Oh, y'all getting ready to fight, aren't you?
No, we just said hello.
Oh, okay. It sounds like y'all, you know, getting to either side of the corral and getting your hands on your guns over here. Let's start out, Michael, with the appointment of Bernard Kerik, a man I'm sure that you're familiar with, having lived in New York, as the new Homeland Security boss. Good hire, bad hire?
Well, you know, his last job, forget the New York police job, his last job was training the Iraqi police. That's been going real well.
Yeah, right. Hey, you're pretty sharp this morning, Michael.
I think his I have a little material after all. See, I think his chief requirement for this job, or his chief qualification for this job, is that he was a pal of Rudy Giuliani, and that he was there on September 11th when Giuliani supposedly whispered into his ear, "Thank God George Bush is president of the United States." That's the main reason he got the job, right?
Now, there is some question as to whether or not that was actually said. Is there, what do you know about that?
I don't know anything about it, but I would bet every penny I have that there's no chance on earth that was actually said.
Rev, how about you? You're not a gambling man. But...
So far, I agree with everything Michael said. I mean, I think absolutely, as I said earlier, it feels like 2 days ago, but about an hour ago, I absolutely think that's the only reason he has the job. And I absolutely would agree with him, and I'm not a betting man, that that was never said. I mean, that's one of those
why
things.
Why not? Why wouldn't Rudy Giuliani have said that?
First of all, I don't see Rudy Giuliani thanking God that anybody's anything other than him. But given that the time he was supposed to have said it, they probably was doing something like, I hope you protected your butt. What's going to happen to mine? I mean, it's absolutely crazy to think at that time that that would have been what they were saying. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael, I think a lot of people were surprised that John Danforth, Episcopal minister and former senator, has resigned for his job as ambassador to the UN.
Danforth, Ridge. I mean, and then I read in the paper this morning, in the Washington Post this morning, that Tommy Thompson is coming. His resignation is coming.
A trifecta.
Yeah, this is more. This is more resignations than a lot more resignations than you normally see at the end of a first term. Of course, you normally see a certain number, but this is a lot more, and you got to wonder why. And you know, I don't know. There, the best theory that I have is that since Karl Rove runs every agency of government anyway, these people feel like they don't have that much to do.
Wow. Now, Michael. Let's talk a little bit about intelligence reform. You're down in D.C. You're in the nation's capital in the belly of the beast. Why can't George Bush, a Republican, get his Republican friends in Congress to get this intel bill done?
Well, because the House Republicans in Congress, they they feel that they're not going to listen to the White House on everything. There are certain things on which they're going to stand up. And they're going to say, we're our own power center, and you have to do what we want to do, because, you know, they feel that they have an expanded majority, and you know, they're to the right of the Bush administration, and there are certain things that they're going to want to push through this year.
You know, I think that he raises something that's very interesting. On Sunday, I was in D.C. doing a Meet the Press, and in the green room, I was talking to former Governor Kaine
from New Jersey, Tom
who
Kaine.
Was over the 9/11 Commission, and that was part of what is becoming clear to me is because now the Republicans have this expanded power in Congress, Senate, and White House, they're now going to get into a lot of internal public fights themselves, because now you can't really say it's us against them. They use Clinton as the lightning rod. All of us must stay united against the wickedness of Bill Clinton. Now that they have this expanded power, I think Tomasky's right. They're going to start calling their own shots at some levels in the Congress and in other places and challenging Bush, because you don't have this ominous threat of Clinton or whoever to unite them anymore, and that's a problem.
Michael, we got to take a break, but when we come back, I want to find out, because you both talked about this power that the Republicans have. The Republicans have had this kind of power before, conservatives in that party. And I want to get into the question of whether or not the conservative Republicans don't usually end up overreaching when they have this kind of power and the consequences of that overreaching. It's 44 minutes past the hour. Michael Tomasky from the American Prospect is our guest. The Reverend Al Sharpton is our guest co-host. Stay with us. We'll be right back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online at MorningSedition.com from Air America Radio.
To announce my nomination of Dr. Condoleezza Rice to be America's Secretary of State. During the last 4 years, I've relied on her counsel.
There's only you in my life.
Benefited from her great experience,
the only
the strength, the grace.
I guess you could say it was love at first sight.
My first love.
I'm very grateful to you. My dear friend and mentor.
I am very much looking forward to joining the fraternity.
And now I'm honored she's agreed to serve in my cabinet.
This is humbling.
I can't tell you how much I love Connie Rice.
He is one of the finest public servants our nation has ever produced.
I can't tell you how lucky I am.
No one else will.
It was my honor to serve alongside him.
And when we come together.
Now, that's an image that I particularly like.
Connie's true ambition is beyond my power to grant. We have one future that binds us. And Connie Rice is the right person for that challenge.
I think we've made the Reverend Al Sharpton speechless.
No, I just want them to know Mark Riley has sole responsibility for the inferences of that tape, and he is in the studio at 3 Park Avenue. Homeland Security wants me to hold him until they arrive. I will be glad to accommodate
them. Well, thank you
Michael
so much.
Tomasky had no knowledge that this was going to be played while he was on. I can be his witness that he and I were totally blindsided by this scurrilous attack on the President and the Secretary of State.
Secretary of State designate to you.
Yeah.
She's not there yet.
See, now you know who knew this right thing to say because he was totally involved in the production.
No. It's 51 minutes past the hour. That is the Reverend Al Sharpton. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley with our special guest, Michael Tomasky, executive editor of the American Prospect. Michael, and Rev, you can get in on this too. Doesn't the conservative wing of the Republican Party usually overreach when they get this, when they amass this kind of power? Newt Gingrich had it in 94. He overreached. They had it in the early 1980s. They overreached back then, too. Don't they usually do this?
Yeah, well, Gingrich definitely did in 94 in a pretty big way. And, you know, they had things in the contract with America that you know, majorities of public opinion didn't support in any way, shape, or form. And so when they tried to pass them, they found that there was more resistance to these things than they thought. And then they thought that, you know, their base hated Bill Clinton so much, they confused their base with the United States, and they proceeded on the assumption that people in the United States uniformly hated Bill Clinton, and that turned out not to be the case, too. And so when Gingrich shut down the government, Clinton won that battle, and then in 98, they pushed too hard on impeachment. Now, today, you know, I think they probably will again, because there are some pretty serious things that they want to do. I mean, they want to do Social Security privatization as fast as they possibly can. They want to try and get that done by April. And in a lot of ways, it looks like they can ram it through.
But, Michael, how real is the Social Security crisis, the shortfall that we hear about that necessitates the privatization? I've heard some people say the Social Security is not in as bad shape as the president's putting it out.
It's not in as bad shape as he's putting it out. There is a long-term shortfall that has to be dealt with. But there are a lot of ways to deal with it, you know, short of what they're proposing. But you know, I just said what they're proposing. We don't actually know what they're proposing because the White House won't put out a plan. The White House kind of wants the House Republicans to put out a plan. And the House Republicans are saying, no, we want to see the White House put out a plan. So they're playing this game of chicken because they know it's pretty high-risk stuff. So on that and on making the tax cuts permanent and on judges and on, you know, and on particularly on abortion. I mean, if Roe v. Wade gets overturned, you know, that may spur a backlash.
No, I think he's absolutely right. I think they're certainly going to go after Roe v. Wade, and I think that's going to cause a tremendous groundswell against him. I think the privatization of Social Security is something that is more complex in terms of public understanding, but I think they're going to fast-track it so that they're going to really overreach there. And I absolutely think his judicial appointments are going to mobilize various different constituencies that will end up coming together. And they feel emboldened. I mean, they are outright saying some of the most right-wing reactionary things that I've heard in many years, openly and arrogantly, and I think that they're going to overshoot the runway.
So now what? I'm sorry, go ahead, Michael.
I'll tell you one more clue, too. I mean, everybody thought in Washington before the election that whether Bush won or lost, that the neoconservatives in foreign policy would be on the downswing after the election because, you know, Iraq was such a mess and because there was a lot of anger within the Republican Party at the neoconservatives. But now we look, and they're on the ascendant. They're in a better shape than ever now in the administration. So how did that happen? And so what are they going to push on the foreign policy side?
Mm-hmm. Now, what issues, Michael, do you think the Democrats ought to pick, assuming that they have to pick and choose their fights with the Republicans because they're in a minority in Congress, what issues do you think they ought to stand their ground on?
Well, to me, the tax cuts are number one, and the deficit and the way that the permanent deficit that these tax cuts are going to create is going to starve the government. And, you know, everybody knows the old adage, people respond positively to Republican rhetoric about, you know, big government and what the bad things that it does. But when you get down to individual programs, people like a lot of things the government does. So I think that's the first thing the Democrats have to do. And they have to be a more economically populist party in opposition, and they have to be a party of conviction, and you know, they have to know that they're going to lose some of these fights because they're in the minority. So when you know you're going to lose some fights, I hope that frees you to stand up and say what you actually believe instead of trying to, you know, trim your sails and run to the center and make agreements with them.
I think that we definitely have to address the American public in a way that connects, and I think that we cannot allow the Republicans to set the tone. We are not a party that does not believe in values. We're not a party that are just these crazy big government, big spending liberals. And I think we've got to address these issues head on. What I have said is that we can't allow them to limit the question of morality to just personal habits. That has very little to do with morality. Morality is how you treat people, like poor people, like seniors, like children. Even this distortion of Christianity. Christianity is a lot more about how you uplift people and how you tolerate people that may, you may feel, have fallen short of what life should be in your regard. I don't think we engage them enough on trying to define in our terms what the debate is. I think we allow them to set the tone and we react. We've got to stop reacting. We've got to put out a proactive agenda of our own.
Michael, real quickly, a group of Democratic governors led by New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson are saying that the party needs to focus, and particularly the Democratic National Committee, needs to focus on local elections and not remain dormant during the 4 years between presidential elections. Good idea or bad idea?
Yeah, it's a good idea as far as it goes. I mean, they need to build a farm.
They need to go further?
Yeah, well, yeah, they do. I mean, they need to go a lot further. They definitely need to build a farm team of candidates who are someday plausible presidential candidates. They need to set up systems that that build the future generation of office holders and of thinkers and even of journalists. I mean, there's this conservative outfit called the Leadership Institute.
Yeah, I've heard of it. Michael, we're out of time, unfortunately.
Oh,
but listen,
sorry.
Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. You take care.
Say, Al, you
yes.
Have a good campaign.
Thank you, Michael.
All right.
I'll read about it in American Prospect.
There you go. I'm feeling the love up in here. The Reverend Al Sharpton and Michael Sabatsky, executive editor of the American Prospect. In the next hour of Morning Sedition, we're going to continue this discussion about the future of the Democratic Party. We've got Bill Roden, esteemed columnist for the New York Times, to talk sports, Balco, steroids, and the like here on Air America Radio. Good morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Good morning, Democrats. Oh, sorry. let me not portray the Democrats as a bunch of crybabies. That wouldn't be a right thing to do. But
then
listen,
why are you playing the crying baby underneath our discussion?
It was there. That's why. Because I could. That's why.
Oh.
The Reverend Al Sharpton is our special guest co-host. He is filling in for my main man, Mark Maron, who is out in the great city of Seattle, Washington.
Doing giggles tonight.
Doing giggles. Now, what's the website? Go ahead. Give it to him.
Giggles.
www.gigglescomedyclub.com. If you're in Seattle, get some salmon and go see Marin. Does that rhyme? No, I guess not. I guess I better not quit my day job. Rev, we're glad you're here. Spending the morning with us. It's been a lot of fun. Let's get back to the future of the Democratic Party, the future of progressive politics in this country. Because I really do believe that whatever schism there is between white liberals and the black community has to be addressed, painful though it may be, and it has to be dealt with on some level or another. And it goes beyond just some of the more emotional parts of this. The black community, for example, is bitterly split over the issue of gay marriage, where the white liberal community is not nearly as split over the issue of gay marriage. How do you resolve that?
I think that would open discussion. See, one of the things that I said during the campaign is the issue of gay marriage, again, was argued wrong. The issue of gay marriage is an issue of human rights and an issue of entitlement. I asked a black clergyman who is a friend of mine, if you pass a constitutional amendment that bars gay marriage, does that stop gays from having sex? He says, of course not. I said, then what is the morality? We're talking about whether they have the same rights that anyone else has. He said, I never thought about it that way. I think that in many ways, the Democrats became so reactionary. They were paralyzed in the position that they couldn't debate the issues in a way that would have given people clarity and therefore room to support issues because they would have seen them in a broader context rather than a very narrow view that the conservatives wanted us to see it in and therefore steamroll the American public political.
Let's talk about a couple of other issues. For example, education, vouchers. Many more people in the black community support the idea of vouchers and charter schools than generally you find in the white liberal community.
But I think that, again, it's a question of interpretation. There will never be enough vouchers. There will never be enough charter schools to take care of all American children. Let's start
Yes,
there.
That's true.
So, example, when I was campaigning in Ohio, where they had the Supreme Court case on vouchers, My question to those in the audience, some who were supportive of that, and this is a black audience, is if there will never be a circumstance that will provide enough vouchers or charter schools for 100% of the public, then how many of you want your kid to be the one that doesn't get the voucher or the charter school? Well, nobody wants that. So what do you want to do? Gamble? Play lotto with whose kid gets a proper education? Or do you want the government committed to all children getting that, therefore have the commitment to public schools? And if you frame it that way, even the most avid supporter of vouchers have to say government's concentration must be on all, not none. Otherwise, we're playing a lotto system on whether my kid hits the lotto. Well, if he doesn't, that means he's going to get an education that does not have the full commitment and the 1,000% backing of government.
Let's talk about an issue that George W. Bush seems to have found that resonates with a lot of people, the whole idea of tax cuts.
Right.
How important do you think tax cuts are to working Americans?
Very little, because first of all, when you see the quality of their life deteriorate to pay for these cuts, they get a few hundred dollars as a tip for a worse lifestyle. And I think that that is the way that George Bush has been able to circumvent the debate by not talking about the impact of these tax cuts. First of all, he's mortgaged the future of this country that could probably break it if these tax cuts become permanent. But secondly, when we look at the fact that it has given us a federal deficit that has never higher than it has ever been before, we have record state deficits. This affects clearly the human services and daily lives in terms of goods and services provided by government of average Americans. So when you count out the cost, there is no way this balances itself out.
Let's talk about local elections. I mean, we hear that and see the Democratic governors saying that the concentration of the party needs to be refocused on the local congressional races, local council races, statewide races, those kinds of things, rather than just looking at the presidency every 4 years. How do you start to do that? Where do you get the gene pool within the party to start running and contesting these elections and winning them?
We've got to get people connected to the gene pool. That's one of the reasons why I'm supporting Marjorie Harris. I'm supporting Greg Meeks. I'm supporting others to come through the ranks that are connected, not only in their cities, but connected nationally to that gene pool that know the leaders that are on the chute, so to speak, ready to emerge and come in. If you ask a lot of the national leadership of the party, who are those prospective new leaders around the country, they couldn't tell you. Well, it's dangerous to have people in national leadership that do not know those potential next generation or even this generation leaders that have the ability and that have the acumen to really revive this party.
866-303-2270, 866-303-2270 is our phone number. We want you to get into the conversation. Later on this hour, we'll be talking with New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden about steroids, the firing of Tyrone Willingham, and much, much more. Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, on the air and online at MorningSedition.com from Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. I'm Mark Riley with my special Mornings Edition co-host for today, the Reverend Al Sharpton, filling in for my main man, Mark Maron, who's out in Seattle. Before we continue our conversation, this is the time of the morning when Ramon usually stops by with information downloaded from the Palm Pilot of someone in the Bush administration. We haven't seen Ramon so far this morning, but Mark Maron is out in Seattle where he's performing tonight at Giggles, and he called in with a message for us.
So I just wanted to let you know, Riley, that Ramon is traveling with me. He's roading for me, and dude, this guy can get anything, anywhere, and he got me the Carlos Gutierrez Palm Pilot for today. If you don't know, I know you do, Riley, but he's Bush's Commerce Secretary. He's the nominee, and he was the CEO of Kellogg's. Here's his schedule. 8 a.m., wake up, shut off Tony the Tiger alarm clock. It's 8! 9 a.m., have a big breakfast of pancakes. Don't have to pretend I like cereal anymore. 10 a.m., overhaul manufacturing sector of economy. But first, more pancakes. Noon, meet with President Bush. Thank him for the big sombrero lamp he gave me for new office. 12:30 p.m., throw out big sombrero lamp. He'll never remember. 2 o'clock p.m., find out who's been sending emails to me as Captain Crunch. 4 o'clock p.m., first big act as Commerce Secretary. Drive Bush twins to new part-time sales job at Lady Foot Locker. I got them for Christmas season. 7 o'clock p.m., meeting with Cheney. Tell him, yes, I would like a painting of myself on display in the White House, but not on black velvet. 9 o'clock p.m., check messages. 9:05 p.m., leave to pick up fired Bush twins at mall. They are not going to screw this up for me. I've worked too hard. 11 p.m., lights out. Make mental note. I wonder if I can finally get my face on a Wheaties box now.
All right, that's the Commerce Secretary nominee Carlos Gutierrez's Palm Pilot for today. Rev, you know, Ramon may hack into your... Do you have a Palm Pilot? You have one of those.
If I did, I'll throw it out after the show.
You have all that modern technology. Let's go to our telephones at 866-303-2270. Let us speak first to Tom, who's calling us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida on WINZ. Hi, Tom.
Morning, gentlemen.
How you doing?
Good. How are you guys?
Excellent.
Good. I wanted to talk about school vouchers again. Reverend Sharpton brought that up a little while ago.
Yeah.
And I kind of just wanted to talk on the whole philosophy of the educational system, not specifically the problems with vouchers, but something's got to be done. We've been going downhill for the last 40 years from both parties. They're not making education any better. They're making it worse. But, and I believe that competition is the way to do it. Right now, the bureaucracy in the public schools is so thick that you can't get through it. You can't make any major changes without something totally different.
Tom, let me ask you a question. Because, you know, one of the things that they've done to foster competition in addition to vouchers is the establishment of charter schools. They just did a study that showed that charter schools aren't doing as well generally, at least in the states they tested, as public schools were.
Right.
Yeah, well, that could be the case, but that's why, then maybe that's even a stronger argument for private schools.
For private schools? Religious or not? Does it make a difference to you whether those private schools are religious?
No, it doesn't.
None at all, as long as they give you a good education.
Exactly.
All right, Tom, thanks a lot, man.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good weekend. Rev, what do you think?
I mean, again, I agree with him that we've not seen education move forward under either party. I do not agree that vouchers is the way, though, to stimulate that competition. We need to stimulate it in a way that we're not sacrificing large bodies, if not the majority, of students that go to public schools in the country. So I think in the haste to solve a problem, you don't sacrifice the children. And I think that's my position on vouchers.
See, I've always thought that vouchers were a little bit of a sucker play because they'll give you $4,000, but if your tuition is six, Where are these poor parents supposed to get the other two jobs?
Exactly. Not only where, first of all, they give $4,000 to some. First of all, let's talk about the fact we're talking about a small pool of people. We're not talking about
everybody
getting this. So you're already eliminating most people. And then you're not giving the people in that small pool the real opportunity that you say you're giving, which was the Ohio case. The amount of money they were given per student really did afford them much different in education than they were getting in public schools. So I agree with you. The terminology sucker punch is apt in this case.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you want to give somebody $40,000 to send them to Exeter, fine.
Right.
But I don't think they're going to. That's not in the cards as far as I heard.
Not in the cards at all.
Let us go next to Bruce, who's calling us from WWAA in Georgia. Bruce, how you doing?
I'm doing better than a whole lot of folks. How about yourself?
All right. What's on your mind?
Yeah, a few years ago, Jesse Jr. wrote this book where he talked about constitutional amendments as the way to go to get the right to education, the right to organize unions, the right to clean air and clean water, and this kind of stuff. When Al, when you were running for president, you talked about that. But I don't hear any other Democrats saying that we ought to do this constitutional amendment stuff. If you're talking about developing new stuff from the gene pool all the way down, what's happening? How come we're not hearing about this?
No, I think that he's absolutely right. I did push it during the campaign, Jesse Jackson Jr., wrote a book about it. I still say that not only is the practical, long-term way to solve a lot of these problems, it is a short-term political organizing tool. Because many of the Republican constitutional amendment drives and state initiatives help drive their vote out. We run personalities at the top of the ticket. They run initiatives in the state. So a lot of people come out, whether we agree or not, against gay marriage on their state to vote, or come out for whatever initiatives they have on the ballot, and then we'll vote for Bush. We don't have any initiatives, any constitutional amendments on the Democratic side. We say vote for our guy or our girl, or that's all we're offering the public. I think that it would be a short-term political strategy that helps the party, as well as a long-term way of constitutionally guaranteeing citizens things like quality health care and public education.
Thanks a lot for that last phone call. Let's go next to Rachel, who's listening to us on WINZ in Florida. Rachel, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. That is to say, I'm knowing I'm sane because I'm listening to you.
Oh, thank you.
I listen to you every day religiously, and I think you're great. And I really have great admiration for the reverend. What I am so concerned about is even broader than the education. And that is, what are we going to do with the traitors and treasonous people in Congress who give us taxation with no representation? They won't allow the Democrats to participate in the voting on the bills unless they see it 3 minutes before, or informing the bills. What are we doing? How are we answering that?
That's a very important question. Rachel, thank you very much for the call. This is something that's been going on behind the scenes, Reverend. It's gone on during this lame duck session of Congress, and it's probably going to extend into the next session, where the Republican caucuses, because they are the majority in both the House and the Senate, whatever the bills are, whatever the different committees are, the Republicans dominate in many instances to the exclusion of their Democratic colleagues on the same committees.
No, I think that is certainly undercuts any idea of democratic process and the representation of the constituencies that the Democrats are there to speak on behalf of. And I think it must be challenged, even if it has to go into the courts. I mean, it is outrageous to think that they could say, we have the votes, we have the numbers, we don't have to discuss this because you can't stop us anyway. So there is no input. Therefore, I think Rachel hit it right, that they're really saying your constituencies will not be represented, which is taxation without representation. I think she's absolutely right.
Let's go next to Mary Ellen, who's calling us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mary Ellen, good morning.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. Hey, I have a whole group of friends who probably have never been politically active before, but are just angry and want desperately to do something, and they don't know what to do.
Talk Reverend Sharpton into running for president again.
Well, that would be great. I love you, Al.
Thank you. How you doing, Mary Ellen?
All right.
I think that you have a reason to be angry. First of all, don't think that there's nothing wrong with being angry, that you're absolutely right. There's a lot to be angry about. You should plug in right there in Ann Arbor with some of the activist groups and some of the political groups that are doing something. We cannot just think that our anger and our emotions alone will change things. We've got to apply that and connect that to something. Even if it's groups that we don't think are active enough, join them and make them active enough. The thing that I've always done all my life, if nothing was going on, I got involved and made something happen. And we've got to be angry enough to make something happen.
You know, we didn't get a chance to do this, and I don't know if we will before the end of the show, but I did want to talk with you because we share a common experience, having lived at a point in Eastern Brooklyn, in Brooklyn, New York, Brownsville, East New York. During the late 60s, early 70s, when those communities were absolutely devastated And it was a common experience that we both share. And it's something that I think we ought to at some point try and share with the audience, because it was a very living in a place where it was like 5 miles to the nearest movie theater, 5 miles to the nearest dry cleaning store. These are things that most Americans have, you know, unless they live in rural areas, have no idea actually take place in urban areas.
In the inner city.
In the inner city. It was an incredible experience. Very depressing, but an incredible experience. But what was uplifting about it was the people that were living there.
And the family, that's family values.
Yes, absolutely. When we come back, Barry Bonds fessed up to those roids, but said he didn't know they were roids. He thought it was flaxseed oil. We'll talk about that with Bill Roden. He is the distinguished sports columnist for the New York Times, and of course, we've got the liberal agenda as well here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley, and Mark Maron is in Seattle getting ready to do Giggles Comedy Club tonight and tomorrow. That's www.giggles comedy club.com. My special guest co-host, the Reverend Al Sharpton. Good morning, Rev.
Good morning, good morning, good morning.
Now, Barry Bonds. For those of you just waking up, Barry Bonds, the man who said he never did steroids, never, now says he did. Or now at least it is revealed, according to the San Francisco Chronicle, that he told a grand jury that he did.
But he said he didn't know it was steroids.
He said that cream they rubbed on him was flaxseed oil, not
right.
steroids.
Right.
Never mind, he went from 40 home runs to 73 in, what, two seasons?
Right.
Does that tell you something about what it was?
Well, again, I'm not saying that.
I know he's innocent until proven guilty. Actually, I'm not even saying that.
I'm just saying the whole thing that he said.
God, the whole thing that he said.
The whole thing that he said is that I never used steroids, and he then allegedly told the grand jury he didn't know it was steroids.
He didn't know it was steroids, but he did use them. Right. Unlike Jason Giambi, who did say that he knew they were steroids, and he used them. And he used them when he was playing for the Oakland A's, which means it goes back at least a couple of years.
Right.
And, of course, Jason Giambi, for those of you who don't follow baseball, has suffered a number of debilitating illnesses, including, I believe, the removal of a tumor. And stories that he was ill with cancer, for goodness sake. Now, I don't know whether that's all steroid-related or not, but the bottom line here is the man got quite sick from trying to build up his body. And, of course, this is all done in the name of money, because these athletes feel like, you know, they have to keep themselves in prime shape in order to make these big contracts. Barry Bonds making $17 million.
That'll make you do a lot of stuff. But I think that clearly... It is going to call for the baseball commissioner. He shows you how much sports I do.
You got Bernie Kerik on the brain.
I'm still on the Kerik appointment to the Homeland Security. But it shows that the baseball commissioner and others are going to be seriously challenged now, based on whatever the public reaction ends up being or not being, on how they're going to police and deal with these matters. And I think that that's what this is going to come down to.
Well, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens here. And, of course, another big story in the world of sports has to do with the firing of Tyrone Willingham,
right,
who was coach of the Notre Dame football team, one of only two black coaches in Division 1A. And he was in the third year of a five-year contract, and Notre Dame doesn't usually get rid of people after only 3 years. And our distinguished guest has just joined us in studio. He is a sports columnist for the New York Times. His name is William Roden. Bill, good morning.
Hey, man, it is great and an honor to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
I've got to ask a question.
Every guest this morning, Bill... Michael Tomasky, Marjorie Harris was distinguished. I got here at 5:45, and I was just your co-host. When do I get distinguished?
But that speaks for, you know, you're distinguished.
We know you're not. None of the rest of us can put reference in front of our name.
I got a cup of water, some yesterday's coffee, and a microphone. Everybody else got all these accolades.
Is the room large enough? We need a large room.
Oh, there you go. So, Bill, welcome, first of all.
Hey. It's great being here.
Now, let me
but you are distinguished, Bill. I don't want to take away from you being distinguished.
Yeah, right.
There you go. Bill, we woke up this morning and found out that the San Francisco Chronicle has released information that Barry Bonds did, in fact, take steroids. Not knowingly, he said, but testified before the grand jury took him. First of all, did this surprise you?
No. Well, the way he phrased it, and I think we have to be very careful with this, okay? Mm-hmm. Really careful, because there are two things going on here. You know, Marion Jones' name is going to be...
Yeah, that's coming up soon.
All that. See, so there are two issues here. There's, and it kind of feeds into the Willingham thing, too, and the lack of that. See, I believe that for a long time there's been this attack on African-American athletes. For a long time. I mean, there are people who have not been happy for the turn of events in the last 25 years. And all of a sudden, you know, it was Jackie Robinson, it was okay. You know, and it's that way in a lot of areas of life. When it's just kind of a couple, okay.
That's cool, yeah.
Now, when you start becoming a dominant force, now it becomes a problem, and it's what I call the jockey syndrome kind of kicks in. Well, we got to find a way begin to eliminate people, okay? So I think that's one thing.
Well, wait a minute. We should explain for our audience. The jockey syndrome goes back to the late 19th century when most jockeys in America, and I'm talking about jockeys now that ran in horse races, were black.
Yeah, I mean, from about the 17th century, actually, to about the late 19th century, black jockeys dominated horse racing. They dominated. They were like the NBA is today. Isaac Murphy in 1875. It was the first Kentucky Derby was run in 1875, and 13 of the 15 jockeys in that race were black.
Mm-hmm.
And from then until the end of that century, black jockeys had something like a 90% winning percentage. They won everything. You couldn't have a race. And before that, it was quarter horse racing, where Charles Stewart, who was a trainer, Charles Stewart at a time in 1831, at a time when blacks couldn't leave the South. Charles Stewart had to have an agent. He was making so much money because he was managing his owners, a large horse racing estate. And this guy was making so much money that he had to have an agent. But he was going from Virginia to the South. He was traveling all over the country. So the point is that...
Talking about Seabiscuit.
Yeah, right?
So I guess what I'm saying is that... But what happened with black jockeys is that after a while, when it started getting big because of them, they organized the Jockeys Club. And what the jockey club did, they said, we got to sort of make this formal in terms of licensing people. So they became the licensing agent of the horse racing industry. Well, guess who wasn't licensed?
Yeah, right.
When it came time for black jockeys to come to be licensed, they weren't licensed. Racetrack owners stopped hiring because white jockeys had started turning on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they said, you know, we can't take a risk anymore. So all of a sudden, they weren't hired anymore. So by about 1903... What was a dominant majority had been for 100 years, all of a sudden you couldn't find them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you would have told somebody like Isaac Murphy, who was making three times as much money, in 1880, he was making three times as much money as the average working white guy. And there were a lot of, if you have told him in 1880 that by 1901, you guys would be eliminated, he said, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, you ask a lot of these brothers now, you know, he said, listen, man, do you think there's any possibility that about 40 years, you guys will be, if you're here, you'll be a minority. Most of these guys will tell you, man, you must be crazy. So in addition to, I think, an ongoing attempt to eliminate them, there's this kind of psychology that we're kind of killing ourselves, you know, being tripping, making the money, the lifestyle, being oblivious to any sense of history. So I think, when we get to the steroids thing, you know, people say, well, I don't care how much you take. Barry, if you could take whatever he took to do what he did, you couldn't buy it. If you can take something to do what this man has done.
73 home runs in a season, 73 over his career.
Mark, because if that was the case, everybody would be taking, everybody would be able to do it. Giambi took, he admitted, what, is he hitting 73 home runs?
Nope.
To get back to then what we're saying, was I surprised? Not really, because baseball hasn't had any kind of testing. Mm-hmm. They haven't had any kind of testing. But remember what Barry Bonds said. He said, I took a cream that was for arthritis. I didn't know that it was steroids.
Yeah, he said he was told it was flaxseed oil.
Now, that's what he said. Marion Jones has steadfastly denied taking steroids. Now, I don't care what, Victor Conti, Tower of Power.
Mr. Balco and the founding member of Tower of Power.
You know, that's another story for another day. You know, I don't care what he says. Marion Jones said she did not take it.
And she's never tested.
She's been tested. She's been tested by all the available apparatus, the legal apparatus. You know, this is America's Constitution. You know, they say, hey, this is a procedure. The procedure cannot catch her. What they've been wanting her to do is catch herself. So she says, I didn't do it. Okay? They've not been able, they said, you know what? We tested her. She didn't do it. Okay? Now, maybe from henceforth, you got to come up with a test or something, you know, that will catch people if that's what you want to do who use steroids. You know, so.
We got to get into that because.
We got to take a break. Next time I have a conference, I want Bill Roden to be my lawyer. You know, I'm trying to fascinate. He's almost convinced me.
Oh, there you go. Bill Roden is our guest.
I know that. I'm just looking at him.
Bill is, of course, sports columnist for the New York Times. It's 44 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back here on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Courtesy of Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is out in Seattle. The Reverend, the distinguished Reverend,
thank
Al Sharpton.
Took me 2.5 hours to get there, but thank you.
No, it took me to get you there.
Bill Roden, sports columnist for the New York Times, is with us. Bill, let's talk Tyrone Willingham. I saw a couple of sports shows over the last couple of days where people were asked very directly whether or not they thought there was anything racial to the firing, and interestingly enough, the answers split right down the middle along racial lines. Tyrone Willingham, of course, the football coach at Notre Dame, fired toward the end of a 6-5 season.
Yeah, I mean, it was the whole thing. It was racial from the very beginning. The hiring was racial. I mean, you know, Notre Dame has never had a black head coach in any sport. Mm-hmm. I mean, any sport. And this is 2003, mm-hmm. 2001. Now, that's a heck of a thing to say.
Yeah.
You know, so it's racial. So the fact that he was hired. I always saw it as a Jackie Robinson kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, Jackie Robinson, Branch Rickey sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, they said, okay, now, was it a great fit? No, but see, Ty's the kind of guy, if you get to know him, he knew that he had to take that job. He knew that it wasn't just about him. It was about him, but it was about every single black head coach who ever wanted to get a shot at a head job. He had to take that job, okay? It wasn't a great fit. But it was Notre Dame, and said, listen, let's try to make this work, okay? Now, see, Notre Dame, what they thought, this is kind of gets into this whole stereotypical thinking. Mm-hmm. They figured, okay, great, we got this brother here, so now every black player in America, from the Deep South, is going to flock to Notre Dame.
Notre Dame, yeah.
You know, first of all, it doesn't work like that. You know, Ty's a different kind of guy. I mean, he's very reserved. He's very more of a military type person, and everybody doesn't relate to that. But to get back to why was it racial, how does the racial thing break down is where Branch Rickey went to bat for Jackie when the stuff got tough. He told people, we're going to stay the course. You know, this is going to work.
That's true.
You know, this is going to work. And because he stayed the course, the fruit was Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, you know, Barry Bonds. I mean, it was fruit. Well, at the moment of truth, Notre Dame backed down. You know, they only went halfway. You know what? When it got too hot and the booths and all that, there was no Branch Rickey there to say, listen, we're going to stay the course. They said, well, Ty, we're going to push you overboard.
Yeah.
You know, so that's to me is the unfortunate part of.
We're talking now about Division I-A football programs. I don't know how many of them there are in the country, 100 some odd at least.
115.
All right. One black coach left, Sylvester Croom down at
Mississippi State.
Yeah, Mississippi State. He's in the middle of a 3-8 season, but they're not getting rid of him.
Well, he just got there.
Yeah. Now, what do you think needs to happen to get more black coaches in Division I-A?
You know what makes me angry, man? I mean, we could, and I guess, you know, Al, you could, from the political thing, you could relate to this. Institutions do what they're going to do. But to me, it's the families I mean, this is a sports industry. It's an industry. And the raw material of that industry is what? It's body.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay? And in Division I football, which is, makes the money, and Division I basketball, which makes money, the driving force of that is what? It's black kids for the last 25 years. What gets me is how you got these parents, and I guess this gets into our mentality,
mm-hmm.
these black parents who continue to send their kids to institutions that clearly do not respect you.
Yeah.
Now, you mean to tell me that, let's just take a school like Stanford. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say Stanford, the past 25 years, turns out political science majors. Now, you mean to tell me in 25 years, there's not one Stanford grad that's not capable of coming back and being chairman of the political, you know,
science department?
If that happens, they say something's wrong. So here we are, major school of the country, Michigan, Ohio, they've turned out for the past 25, 30 years, black athletes
by the thousands.
And you mean that one of those kids is capable of coming back and being an athletic director? You're talking about coaches. Athletic directors are almost worse. You've got three athletic directors. And that's not to mention, Jesse had a hell of a thing a few years ago. He said, you know what? What we ought to do is have a scorecard. So recruits know that when you're being recruited by Ohio State, not only do you know who the black coaches are, but you know, well, how many tenured black professors do they have there? How many chairmen of the department do you have? Because if you look at this at a totality, it's an embarrassment. And so to me, I think that...
And put those scorecards in the hands of the public.
Let everybody know that, hey, this is the deal. But to me, though, it gets back to the mentality of our people that we continue to send our kids to these institutions that clearly have no intention of reabsorbing you in 10, 15 years when it's time for you to become the head coach, something like that.
Let's talk about another issue that's coming out in sports. Ricky Williams, the running back for the Miami Dolphins.
Now you're losing me.
is he just a crazed doper, like some people are saying? Is he just a misunderstood young man? I mean, this is a guy who quit football because he just wasn't feeling it, apparently. Went through a situation where the Miami Dolphins went to court and got $8 million judgment against him. I guess he was feeling it a little, according to published reports, but then the NFL offered him what seemed to be a dream deal, a four-game suspension. He could be reinstated, and yet he turned him down cold, said he wanted to go to some college out in California.
Yeah, this is crazy. You know, I mean, in the abstract, theoretically, yeah. I mean, because we say, oh, like, it was like Jim Brown,
yeah,
left at the top of the game, Barry Sanders, top of the game, and all that.
And he had spent time with Jim Brown, hadn't he?
Not enough time. Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is, you know, I mean, you know, daughters playing on a team and all that. You see, there is a certain degree of element of responsibility that comes with being on a team when it's not just about me, but it's about you. So I'll tell you at the beginning of training camp, listen, I ain't feeling this. I'm not going to go. But, you know, but 2 days before the season, and I'm telling you, and our whole thing is based on you. And you say, I ain't feeling it. I think that stretches. But, you know, that kind of gets back to what we talked about at the beginning of my segment here,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, you have no sense of history.
Right.
I mean, like 40 years ago, man, you talk about Tank Younger and these guys, were, and even before that, you know, Levi Washington, these guys would do anything to get a shot to play. You know, now here we got to the point where you could just say, I don't want to play. And not only that, I'm going to wait till the day before training camp. I ain't feeling that one.
Bill Roden, thank you so much for being with us, man. It's been entirely too short. We got to get you back up here again.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Right now. Oh, God, I almost read the wrong thing. Mark Maron is traveling in Seattle today, but this time every morning he reads us the day's marching orders from the Streisand compound for all good liberals out there. And even though he's out of town, nothing can stop him from delivering today's liberal agenda.
Thanks, Riley. I had Streisand actually fax it to me here at the hotel in Seattle. By the way, I'm in Seattle tonight and tomorrow night. How would that be if you come down? GigglesComedyClub.com. Check it out. Anyways, here's the liberal agenda. Write these down. 1. Refer to all of Bush's new cabinet appointees as temps. 2. Call Tom Brokaw, now that he's retired, offer him a job on Morning Sedition reading today's liberal agenda. Huh? 3. Add a new subject to public school curriculum, conflict resolution between arrogant millionaire athletes and irresponsible drunken fans. 4. Deface Lemony Snicket movie posters to read George W. Bush's A Series of Unfortunate Events. 5. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. There are only 22 days until Christmas, but how many days until the end of the war in Iraq? Now that would be a present, man. Wake up, people.
Thank you very much, Mark Maron. He's going to be back with us Monday, live in studio. Reverend Sharpton, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mark. This has been very enjoyable and informative.
All right. You know you're not getting paid, right?
No, you did not tell me.
Well, we'll see.
Well, the picket line will be outside in an hour.
Mark Maron returns on Monday, and we'll be joined by another reverend, the Reverend Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, who will sit in with us for the entire show, plus Dr. Helen Fisher, author of Why We Love, The Nature and Chemistry of Romantic Love, and a professor of anthropology at Rutgers University. She'll be discussing how and why sexuality is manipulated by the elite. Is that me? I have no idea. Have yourselves a great weekend. Take care, Rev. Take care, Bill.
Take care.